It's just
This is Solidarity Journal. Share in a common voice. Just might find your own.
To think that this was John Doe.
It's like the argument about the argument in part. No, we fought an entire goddamn war. States' right to do what?
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing up.
It's October 11th, and you're listening to Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica radio affiliate. I'm your host, Michael Perillo. On today's show, we'll have a discussion with Eric Stoner, an activist and freelance writer and editor of Waging Nonviolence. And we talked about how nonviolence plays a very intricate role in today's society. Also, Razia Ahmed and I sat and spoke with Ali Gorhar, who's from the Peshawar province in Pakistan, and is founder and advisor of Just Peace International, which uses Jirga, an indigenous way of peace-building, with those living along the Afghan and Pakistan border, and communities elsewhere. He'll also talk about nonviolence in Islam. And, for featured music today, will be Corey Flanagan. So stay tuned to Solidarity Journal, and prepare to be radicalized. You listen to Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica radio affiliate. I'm your host, Michael Perillo. This past week, I spoke to Eric Stoner, co-founder and editor at Waging Nonviolence. Eric originally came from Dunlap, Illinois, and went on to University of Illinois, graduating with a degree in political science. From there, he went to Spain for his master's in peace studies. He came back to the States and worked at a think tank called the Center for International Policy, which is located in Washington, D.C. Afterwards, he went on working with the War Resisters League, and then from there, went on to write for The Nation magazine. Eric then started his own blog site, Waging Nonviolence, which the two of us kind of had a chance to talk about, to kind of find out what the site does and how nonviolent action works and how it's being used today to bring down ruthless dictators around the world and how it's being applied here in the United States.
Yeah, we started the site primarily because, you know, I started it with a couple of journalist friends of mine here in the city. And, you know, we're interested in the subject in kind of how nonviolent action works. Kind of looking at all the different kind of protest, social movements are happening around the world, and realized that there really wasn't a site that was dedicated to trying to, you know, report on, document, and analyze, all of these things that are happening. And And so we kind of thought, well, if it doesn't exist, why not give it a try ourselves? So we started the site, and you know, we have a few kind of broader goals, I guess, with the site. The first would be to kind of be a forum for activists who are engaged in their own movements for their own social justice issues, and people can kind of come and see what's happening around the world. You know, what kinds of actions are taking place, what's working and what's not working, and kind of hopefully we can learn from each other so that we can see, you can kind of make our efforts more effective in the long run. We also realized that, like, the mainstream media, you know, just regularly misses the story or misinterprets the story, and so we saw our site as kind of being hopefully a corrective to the mainstream media's coverage. That's kind of an important goal. So we will, you know, take an article from the New York Times, for example, that, you know, kind of, you know, was about the Egyptian Revolution, but, you know, kind of really misunderstood what was happening because they don't, you know, generally, you know, journalists, these mainstream journalists are taught to kind of, you know, they know how to cover violence, they know how to cover war, but they don't really understand what they're looking at when they're trying to document or report on kind of a nonviolent movement. So we try to then provide a more nuanced, you know, analysis of really what's happening and kind of point out where the mainstream media kind of misinterprets things. So that's kind of another important goal. And we hope, you know, eventually to kind of be a go-to place for the mainstream media to kind of get analysis of these movements. You know, if we are providing kind of like the most in-depth, thorough kind of coverage of these things as they're unfolding. So, and that started to happen. We're getting, you know, more and more opportunities to be on TV and you know, in radio and things like that to kind of get this other perspective out there.
You said the as far as the mainstream media goes, as far as talking about and covering nonviolence, you kind of made a good point there, is that they mostly deal with covering violence, war zones. You think they're purposely at times not wanting to shed light onto the subject, that how effective nonviolence is?
Well, it's hard to know what the intention is. I mean, I think it's probably a twofold, you know. I think part of the misrepresentation of things is just based on ignorance, you know, and based on the fact that people still don't really understand how power works and how kind of how these movements function and build and are effective. And so, you know, they may completely misunderstand things that they're seeing. So, you know, when, for example, you know, the police crack down and people can, and the protesters remain kind of nonviolent, steadfastly nonviolent, you know, it may be reported as just a, you know, a real mess, you know, a real bloody kind of crackdown or something, as you see happening in a lot of countries right now. But, you know, that can actually be a real strategic kind of move on the part of the protesters, and actually can be a real turning point, because, you know, when there is repression of nonviolent movements, it almost always serves to kind of backfire against the state, against the police or the security forces, because people realize the injustice in that. So you know, it may be reported as kind of a real blow to the movement, when actually it could be a real turning point in favor of the movement. It's that kind of thing that they just don't understand kind of the dynamics of it. But on the other hand, I think, you know, there may be some intentionality to it as well, in that, you know, the mainstream media is owned by, you know, a handful of extremely large, powerful corporations. And, you know, almost everything we see, read, or hear is now kind of coming out of, I think, you know, just literally a handful of mega corporations. So corporations have their own interests, and those interests will often clash with the interests of the majority of the population. And so I think there's also there could be some, you know, intention to misreporting nonviolent movements as well, because, you know, you kind of want to, you know, I think the status quo, the people in power, you know, don't want people to catch on, right? That this is really how change happens, you know, that it doesn't happen primarily, I believe, through the, you know, through the electoral process, but it happens by grassroots, you know, groups kind of organizing and putting pressure and on people in power, you know, on, you know, politicians and corporations through all these nonviolent methods. And so there's also, I think there may also be, you know, the mainstream media may have an interest in kind of muddying that and not helping the general population understand that there is real power in nonviolent action.
Mm-hmm. With that being said, when the police and the authority does use violence, what is your views on activists and their attitudes towards the authority?
I feel that, you know, I mean, there's different approaches to nonviolence. One is just kind of a strategic approach that looks at strategies and tactics and how to make it effective. The other side is more principled, and that would be kind of the school of thought that, you know, Gandhi and Martin Luther King and folks like that are coming out of. And I think no matter which perspective you take on nonviolence, there's a very strong, I think, case to be made for not responding in kind, you know, to violence from police or security forces, and also even towards to kind of reaching out to them, because you know, ultimately the police, I believe, are not the problem. The problem is more in the concentration of political power, in economic power, in government and in corporations. And so, you know, one of the most kind of important factors in many successful nonviolent movements, revolutions, has been whether the protesters can kind of create defections within the security apparatus and kind of win some of the police or military forces over to their side, so that there's kind of a split, and that's kind of when the state starts to, you know, lose its power, right, and things start to crumble. So it's more about trying to kind of create that division within the state.
Would it be correct to say that's sort of like a moral jiu-jitsu?
Yeah, it's kind of like using there are different phrases. Oftentimes jiu-jitsu is in there, like political jiu-jitsu, moral jiu-jitsu, where you are kind of, flipping things on their heads, you know, you can't kind of compete with the state on the question of violence generally, you know. It's they generally have a monopoly, you know, on the use of force. So you're kind of using another avenue, and one that kind of they're not prepared for. Mm-hmm. When you use nonviolence, and it kind of can, you know, totally change the equation. So it's kind of like, in jiu-jitsu, where you have, you know, you kind of use the weight of the person to their own, to their own disadvantage. You know, you it kind of changes the equation.
How do you apply nonviolence in your daily life? I mean, were you always someone that believed in nonviolence, or did it come upon you slowly?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I've really come a long way in terms of my thinking on this. I'm from, like you said, I'm from Peoria originally, and grew up there, and kind of had a pretty conservative worldview through high school and through most of college. And, I believed very strongly that we needed to have a strong military, that this is the way to defend ourselves, and that there are bad people out there that are only going to really respond to violence. You know, that some people, you know, that's just the way that it is, and it's unfortunate, but, that's how life is. And I kind of had, you know, I think that's how most people think. And I had that thinking pretty much intact through college. But I went to Washington, D.C. to do an internship. And I was working for a place that was doing private intelligence, private security, to help kind of protect the interests of, you know, Fortune 500 companies around the world. And at the same time, I ended up stumbling into a class called Alternatives to Violence, or Solutions to Violence. And we were studying peacemakers and nonviolence, studying Gandhi and Martin Luther King. And, it was just this whole other world that I had never really heard of or didn't understand. And I kind of came to see that basically there, you know, my understanding of things, there were a lot of holes in my thinking, and that I didn't, you know, we started studying, you know, these different stories of forgiveness, of people using nonviolence in their daily lives to solve problems, but also kind of on an international level, and, looking at how people have stopped, really nasty, brutal governments without going to war and without bombing people, and that there are these nonviolent methods that have been very effective. And it kind of made me realize that, that I didn't have everything figured out, and that maybe, you know, my understanding of things was wrong. And over the course of that summer, I really came to believe that there was another way, and that nonviolence was a better way, and that this was the real way that we were going to build a more peaceful world, not by having, you know, the largest military in the history of the world and using, you know, force, in so many places to try to build that better world. So, I guess I just kind of had this kind of change in my thinking, and it also connected with my faith background. I kind of grew up Catholic, and I started to appreciate and look at Christianity in a different light, and, you know, see it more as about being with people on the margins, being with people that are struggling, and about resisting, you know, violence. And I think that I kind of realized that what I was doing with my life was kind of the opposite of that. I was helping defend the wealthy and the powerful, and I kind of started to see a real disconnect between what I was doing and my faith, and so I decided to kind of change.
I asked Eric why it is that it seems that more people support violence or war than nonviolence.
I think the reason why most people support war or, you know, any of these other issues, I believe is because of kind of a lack of understanding, you know, a lack of knowledge. And when I used to be very supportive of war, and of having, you know, a very strong military and generally of kind of the status quo, it was because that's all that I had ever been taught. You know, I never was exposed to another way of looking at the world or making sense of things. And, you know, it's, you know, it makes sense when that's all that you know. You know, for example, with Iraq, you know, Saddam was a very bad guy. You know, he killed a lot of his own people. And if you, you know, it makes sense to try to want to stop that, right? That's a natural inclination, and that's a good thing, you know, to care about that. But when you couple that with an ignorance about, what our foreign policy is really about, and the fact that we historically, you know, don't really care about human rights and protecting civilian life, and that even in Iraq itself, we, you know, supported Saddam Hussein and armed him, and, you know, these weapons that we were trying to stop were weapons that we had sold him, when you couple that kind of idealistic, you know, thinking, you know, which is positive, with an ignorance about how we really act in the world, and also with an ignorance about kind of how, you know, you can stop, you know, dictators like Saddam Hussein through nonviolent means, you know, you get a kind of a pretty belligerent, you know, kind of pro-war type of thinking that is very, I think, dangerous. And so, you know, what needs to happen is, you know, we have to just really work at educating people, you know, about this other way of interpreting things and looking at the world. And there's a lot of evidence, you know, to back up, you know, that perspective. I mean, just taking a real sober look at our foreign policy, you know, going back decades, should dispel anybody of the idea that we go to war because we care about the local population, you know, or because we care about democracy or human rights. I mean, there's just so much evidence to the contrary of us supporting repressive governments when it's in our interest and overthrowing democracies when they go against our interests, that it's only based really on ignorance that somebody would kind of buy into that line. So, you know, we have to just work at, I think, at first at, you know, working through our immediate circles, meaning talking to our family and friends, you know, that we have those connections with, to kind of hopefully expose them to this other way of thinking. And then we need kind of a more systematic approach through, I think, the other channels, you know, through the education system and trying to impact the local media, but also to try to, you know, if that is not budging, to try to create our own media, which is what you're doing, which is wonderful. You know, it also comes about through protest, I believe, you know, through nonviolent action. And that can also be very educational for people. You know, if you can do that in a way that gets people to think outside of the box and you know, can engage people in a way that maybe they haven't been engaged. So, you know, it's a long struggle, you know. I think it doesn't come about through elections. It comes about through kind of the difficult, long work of kind of building relationships and education, that we kind of are going to be able to shift our culture and to shift our way of thinking, both in Peoria and kind of around the country and around the world.
Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica Radio affiliate. I'm your host, Michael Perillo. You listen to Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica Radio affiliate. I'm your host, Michael Perillo.
I just wanted to make a quick announcement before we go to our next segment. The Occupy Blono will be having a march in Bloomington Saturday, October 15th, from ISU to Bloomington, and that will be in solidarity with the International Day of Action. It'll start 9 a.m., and people meet up at ISU Bridge. They'll also have a General Assembly training session. Then at 10 a.m., the march to Bloomington, which will be parallel to ISU Homecoming Parade. 11 a.m., should arrive downtown Bloomington during the Farmers Market, and then noon, right back downtown to Bloomington's General. And then at noon, back downtown Bloomington to have a General Assembly. So go ahead and check that out this Saturday. Also, there will be a meeting. Also, there will be a meeting this Thursday in Peoria for Occupy Peoria, where many will meet down at the Liberty, I believe it's Square Plaza, right there on the riverfront on the Peoria side. I think across from Rhythm Kitchen at 5 p.m. That's Thursday at 5 p.m. So go down there and check us out. And also on Saturday there'll be a march here in Peoria as well, in solidarity with the International Day of Action. So should be meeting probably down at Maine and University at noon. So also be there. And so yeah, our next segment, we got to spoke with Ali Gorhar, who lives in Pakistan along the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and has been doing work with Just Peace initiatives, which outreaches to communities in that area for nonviolence and peace. So I got to sit down with him in Razia and talk more about what is going on with that. Ali, what is it that that you do? Like, what's give us a day in your life, what you do with the Just Peace International in the Pakistan, in, on along the border there in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
I'm from the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, where mostly the people are Pakhtun across the border. They are in Afghanistan. The majority are in Afghanistan and Just Peace International, which is now changed. So now it's Just Peace Initiatives. The name shows Just Peace. If you think on one, so only peace. And if it is on another side, so Just Peace means Justice and Peace Initiative. So we are here because my indigenous way of peace building here, and that is called Jirga. Mm-hmm. Jirga is like NATO American circle. Like there, we, the Pakhtun, they consider themselves one of the oldest tribes on this planet. As they claim that their 5,000 history are known. So Jirga is with them from right from 5,000 years back. And with the flood, many sort of the NGOs and the donor attention was diverted to the immediate relief. So the 2010 onward, like 11, we were supposed now busy in rehabilitation of the flood-affected area, like in water and sanitation and skill development and reconstruction and all this infrastructure development. Many NGO and donor and UN were supposed was just looking for me because now they, like with the Bacha Khan, which is the one who started even before Gandhi, this non-violent movement in this my province, organized 100,000 army. They were known as Servant of God. So they established school, and they approached me And next week, inshallah, we are going to start the peace education and the Bacha Khan philosophy and the religious and traditional one, the peaceful thing in the 14th school there. I have to train the principal, the teacher, and then to go with them to each school to teach them practically about restorative justice system, about peace education and that. There is another in the conflict area where our the mostly violent conflict area, our tribal area and Swat Valley. There is the UN DP now. We have a meeting last week, and very soon we are starting a project, inshallah, in that area also on the revival of indigenous system like Jirga, how to revive it and how to make it approachable to the marginalized community like women, children, and other minorities. So this thing is another initiative. I am also now today, suppose, and yesterday I was with UN Women, how the gender justice, especially the violence against women, that should be minimized, and how it should be the through which way the conflict transformation method should be taught to the people on the grassroots level.
So when they keep on talking about the billions of dollars of aid that United States is giving to Pakistan, people don't see much of it, do they? How much do they see? Do you see?
The thing is, they can't see it first. And the thing is, that if one drone come again, everything is washed, you see. So you are giving, I told you already, that you are giving carrot and stick together. So the stick power is more known. If these innocent people are killed or killing, so that is more as compared to what the small sort of things which we have given as a relief or food or any other assistance.
How has the floodings contributed to this problem as well?
But people forget about it. Now the burning issue is this. People are, if they are dying, so we are already, there are many dead on daily basis in Pakistan going on. Because there is, another issue is, there is for the US and the Western countries, there one person who killed 2-3 people in Lahore, and there was from up to the president a lot of pressure on Pakistani government. But if we are killed in 100 and 1,000 on a daily basis, no problem. Even the West is, there is, I'm sorry to look sometime to the media, how they portrayed us and how this thing is, because they think that they are all terrorists, they are all this, and they killed so many terrorists when the drone attack comes or any other attack comes. So the human value is different there and here. And then the sort of the criteria is also different for those people and our people.
Yeah.
And this double standard, it is now known to every person, even to a child, you see, and they realize it. And this is a very unfortunate, I can say, that America is not only, they have done good thing also, but one bad thing make all the thing,
It's easier to forget all that good stuff once you kill a lot of innocent people.
Could you mention some of the good things?
Good thing, suppose there was some Bashar Dam. This was that we will assess them. It was there the power crisis here, so they said suppose we will give to this. There was some another dam development for the construction of the other dams. Like in the agriculture sector, there was some sort of agreement going before some time. So these were like the infrastructure development was ones like the USAID were planning here. There are many advertisements came. Even I applied for that, and then the next day in the newspaper came, sorry, they advertised one day and canceled the next day that we want to rebuild this infrastructure in the flood affected area. Something like that. So, but it is gone.
Violence in Karachi, some people say, is between Pathans or people who migrated or are transplants from Peshawar of Pakhtunkhwa area into Karachi, and then there's a conflict of interest or friction between Urdu speaking or the Sindhis and the Pathans. Is Jirga, or is your peace activity, peace action, or doing anything or involved at all anyway?
Karachi problem is not between Pakhtun or Punjabi or Baloch. There is the problem where there is Karachi is a financial hub. There are different people and there are different agencies involved. You see, and they make it that this is Pakhtun is one thing that they, as I mentioned, that they, to any sort of action from Pakhtun side, there is always a reaction. So Pakhtun are blamed because in some area the Pakhtun also react. You see, so they gave it a sort of a push that it is between the Urdu speaking or Pakhtun or something. No. It is like Balochis are also involved, Sindhis are also involved, so it is not between the Pakhtun or the Urdu-speaking. Urdu-speaking people are the same as we are. Like in Pakistan, they are, suppose the people say Urdu-speaking are migrated. So Afghan are 1.6 million are migrated here in our province. There is no such thing here. And those Afghan are there also. They were welcomed by the Urdu-speaking. All the bread, like oven, like Razia, you have seen there, that is by Afghan. Transport is by the Pakhtun. The hoteling are by the Pakhtun. And the street small shops are by the Pakhtun. And they were living very, from the last many years, like brother. Now if it's happened, so me, there is something external hand also, which people felt it, and it is. Which is also external. If there is Sunni Shia Tassel, it was not before. But externally something happened and it is now started between. So, like it's happened everywhere, like in the Afghan, when they were fighting from Peshawar, their offices were here, the seven parties, they were one. But when the Russian withdraw and they went went to Kabul, so they start fighting with each other. You see, that's why the Taliban came. So there is always something, and that is, again, I will say, some say it is one or some say another. Some say it's American and other will say it is Pakistan and ISI and this and that, which is making an excuse for a different other reason.
Do you think the United States is really going to leave Afghanistan? They're building bases like cities in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Do you think they'll really withdraw?
But they show it to the world and they said that, okay, if maybe the internal factor also, like recently the crisis, you see, the financial crisis in that, because there is a 3 trillion or sometime it come to 3 trillion more dollar per year on the expenditure here. And it is from the people taxes who are there, which is coming and spending, and on whom it is spending here in this Pakistan and Afghan war. So definitely it will affect the economy, and maybe because of their treason, if they are not leaving, so maybe minimize their army here, make it less, because they have technology. So maybe the ground forces, I don't know, I am not expert in this field, and maybe they are thinking that to minimize it, but they have like 2014 to withdraw, something like this. I don't know whether it will be or not.
When did you start using non-violent methods to help others in your community, in your area, and
There are some full-fledged, but I don't know, yeah, you want to listen to me. Actually, my family was involved in enmity, and I opened my eyes in that enmity. And it was started in 1923 and it finished in 1978. And then another one is started, it took 7-8 years after the Jirga involvement and reconciliation, and then the third one started. So when I was even a school student, so I was looking that how I should work for the betterment, that the people should not kill each other in this enmity, because this the recent flood of violence came after 2001, 9/11. But before that, we have a lot of internal enmities in there. And that was right from the childhood. I was looking for an opportunity. Then I worked for Afghan refugees for 14 years. And they make my quest more for to work for non-violence and peace. And because I resolved many issues through Jarga and through this reconciliation. And then in 2001, I got this opportunity to went to the Eastern Mennonite University for this conflict transformation degree. And there, Mennonite are all very peaceful people, and then the atmosphere in the there in community is wonderful, and I feel like at home. I was with my family. Even 9/11 took place in my just my land after 2 weeks, and I was with my family. So working for refugees here, I myself feel a threat, but this Mennonite community, and they helped me a lot. And there I learned the practical stories of other part of the world also. And then being a Muslim, I don't know the stereotype or the media how we are presented there, but we believe on this that God don't need any sort of work for himself. If you want, so work for his creation without any Muslim, Hindu or whatever. So I thought there that I should now start work from a platform where it should be to make the other life peaceful, easy. And that quest and that sort of my thirst for the peace, when I came back, so I said, now it's a time I have knowledge also. For the Jarga, suppose I was there with this restorative justice system. For the traumatized people, there was trauma healing course. I learned the techniques and methods. For the the community sort of gender-based violence and all. So with every sort of problem, there was techniques and knowledge in my hand. And I said, now this is the time to utilize this knowledge for the betterment of the God's creator. And this, I start here. So the real work started in 2003. Otherwise, my work was from my childhood.
Well, there are double standards. You know, when a Christian like Andre Breivik commits a crime, even though he is basing his whole idea of attack on, you know, based on what he read on the web with the other Christians in the United States and all that, but he's labeled as, you know, one crazy person.
Yeah.
When one crazy person, Muslim person, commits a crime, it's a whole Islam is doing.
Whole Islam and whole Muslim country, 45 are fundamentalists, terrorists, and all these, and then. Among the Muslim, then Pakistan, and in the Pakistan, then Pashtun. You see, we are the fundamentalists, we are the terrorists, we are this and that. Oh, we in this country, in this part of the world, organized 100,000 army in 1930. The first and last army of the world that was non-violent. And they fight with British non-violently. Even there is one incident in our Peshawar city, that the colonel, he ordered at 11 o'clock in the morning to fire in the procession. Two people from both sides were coming. They were killed. And this was an honor to take bullet on your chest. So two people from both sides were coming and they were killing them. And after when the figure reached to about 200, then the colonel and the whole battalion, they deserted. And they refused this order. And they were given 10 to 20 years sort of punishment by the British Army. So we are those people, but nobody looks to that. Even it was before Gandhi in this part of the world. So nobody is looking to that. And the new thing, which is, like suppose in 9/11, if there was any Pashtun Any there was any Pakistani, any Afghan in 9/11? No.
So did you hear what Mike Mullen said recently about ISI and Haqqani group combined?
Or what a proxy war and something like that, yes. And then Mullen was very good, and he was saying Pakistan is doing well, very well before. I don't know at the end what's happened. He's retired, so going to be retired too, I think.
What do you think of what he said?
What the other people are thinking, the same is my thinking. This is this Mike Mullen, a year before, 6 months before, he was saying Pakistan is doing very well. Pakistan is doing this, and this is a partner, and this. I don't know what's happened. And the people know what's happening. You see, because the situation in Afghanistan and the situation, the economic position in the U.S. and all over the world is very strange. And because of their reason, the people are not that much stupid. What the people in the U.S. they are thinking that they will be. Pakistani are a very clever nation. You see, they know what's going on and how we are utilized, how we were used in different, like in 71 war. Razia, you are Pakistani. You know what's happened. This, the American sort of the plane were coming and this and that. Well, till date, they didn't reach to the border of the Pakistan. So these are like the sort of things. It is always that the American interest, if there is interest, so the poor countries are also their interest, you see. So leave those countries on their own. Let these countries don't teach them more from above. Let these people should learn on their own to stand on their own feet. And if you can help them, okay, against the terrorism, against help them more economically, financially, you see, and let them try that they should stand on their own feet.
So you think the United States is scapegoating Pakistan for their failure in Afghanistan?
That is not me thinking. This is every Pakistani.
What's the intricate part of nonviolence, you know, as far as demonstrating, is there any of that going on, or is it just more something else as far as organizing or working in communities? Like, how does it kind of play out in Pakistan?
In this situation, the people become more violent. You see what is going on now, especially the present threats which we are listening from the last 1 or 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So the people, every non-violent become violent, you see. And it is creating a problem for us, for the people who are working for peace, for the non-violence thing. So it is because everybody, everyone is thinking that what we have done, how many sacrifices these countries have given, how many people, innocent people are killed. You see, and the end result is this, that you will be attacked also, we will do this also. Okay, you are powerful, you can do that, yes, we agree this. But the poor also, what they think, they will die. So there is, like Martin Luther King said, you can kill my body, but not my soul.
Listen to Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica radio affiliate. I'm your host, Michael Perillo. Recently, Razia Atman went to Chicago on the protest of the Afghanistan invasion, a war that has gone on for 10 full years. She got some audio from a speech that Mary Dean made, a woman who is from Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and recently went to a trip to Afghanistan. She spent 7 weeks in Afghanistan in this year alone. and she's been going to conflict areas for 25 years. So she had much to say on that Saturday morning in Chicago.
In August, I visited a hospital in Kabul called the Emergency Surgical Center for Civilian Victims of War. It's run by an Italian organization, and it provides free care to all victims of war. Being a physical therapist, I had the opportunity to accompany the medical staff on their rounds through wards filled to capacity. The true reality of the senselessness and grotesqueness of this war truly hit home after 4 hours of visiting one patient after the next, with the largest wounds I've ever seen, triple amputations due to mines hitting children and adults, multiple fractures, spinal cord injuries, and blindness, lives destroyed. Over an estimated 40,000 victims have been killed since the U.S. invasion of Iraq, one of the least developed countries in the world. The average life expectancy actually dropped this year from 44 to 42 years old. The whole time I was there, I kept thinking about if I were an average Afghan citizen, I would not be alive right now. According to UNICEF, it is the worst place in the world to be a child or a mother, and 1 in 4 children die before the age of 5. Millions have fled the violence of the war and have been displaced to the capital of Kabul. I was shocked to see this city of 5 million with no sewer system, bombed out buildings, mostly unpaved roads, and the worst air quality in the world. We visited one of the refugee camps on the outskirts of Kabul where thousands of families live. The housing consisted of mud walls and floors covered with roofs covered by plastic tarps to offer some privacy, though there is little protection from the winter snow and cold there. They have little access to food and water and no electricity or sanitation.
Hey, darling.
The poverty was extreme. Right across from the street from the refugee camp is a brand new U.S. NATO military base, which stretches out over a mile long. And when we traveled outside of the capital, we saw many new U.S. NATO military bases popping up everywhere. The psychological effects of the violence have also been devastating, with the majority of the population suffering from PTSD and significant mental health problems. Drones are dropping bombs on civilians daily. Terror-inducing assassinations, 3,000 night raids a year, secret prisons, and torture are only increasing anti-U.S. anger. The pain and suffering will last for generations. It costs the U.S. taxpayers over $10 billion per month for the war in Afghanistan. Military contractors outside legal and legislative scrutiny now outnumber U.S. deployed troops. General Smedley Butler said in 1935, war is a racket. While U.S. corporations benefit economically, over 1,600 U.S. soldiers have been killed and tens of thousands wounded. The majority of the people in both Afghanistan and the U.S. now want the war to end. In spite of this, however, the U.S. is currently in negotiations with the Afghan government to sign the U.S. Strategic Partnership Agreement. According to this agreement, the U.S. will maintain military bases there until the year 2024. There are no military solutions to the problems in Afghanistan. We are propping up a corrupt government and paying off corrupt warlords. This is done in order to transport supplies and protect private contractors carrying out ill-advised work projects by U.S. companies. The primary issues of Afghanistan remain ones of social defragmentation and poverty, which can only be solved through economic development and strengthening of social institutions. There is no more room or time for excuses. The war in Afghanistan, now the longest war in U.S. history, needs to end. On moral, financial, and strategic grounds, the continuing of the war cannot be justified.
Well, that does it for today's show. I'd like to thank Razia Hotman for doing the interview, for one of the segments, and also editing part of today's show. I'd like to thank Corey Flanagan for the featured music on today's show. And that song was called One In Last One Out. So remember that you can tune in and listen to the Solidarity Journal every Tuesday at 6 a.m. and 2 p.m. And if you miss the show, you can go to radioforall.net. That's the number 4. And type in Solidarity Journal, and you can listen to all the prior episodes all the way back since February, March now. So check that out. Otherwise, so until next time, keep up the resistance.